Simon, I know we usually end the podcast talking about your shirts, but I want you to talk about Morrissey and Suede Head, which is, for those who are not watching the podcast, that is what Simon's wearing in the form of a crew neck sweatshirt, or is it a knit sweater? I can't really tell what that is, but there is a collar underneath it, meaning, dude, you're just classing up today. Is that it?
The collar underneath is the shirt that I'm probably going to wear the rest of the day because it's getting warmer by the second. I just flew into Bozeman. It's 30 degrees cooler here than it is on the East Coast, which is really nice. And I prefer to wear long sleeves. But Suede Head, record by Morrissey. If you're watching and you're familiar with Morrissey, then my hair makes a lot more sense. And otherwise, just a great, great record.
What about the glasses and the mustache? Which phase of Morrissey is that?
Yeah, no, I don't think either of those really.
No. Yeah.
I should get a Suede Head tattoo. So we'll keep your eye on the space for Simon probably getting Suede Head tattooed on himself somewhere.
Keep your eye on the space, he says. Yeah, what are you going to like space. Show it? Are you going to like you meme post
I'm
your new tattoos?
Somewhere like here on the throat, but we'll see.
In the middle of the throat.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. It's a good spot.
That's a good idea. With a middle of the throat Morrissey tattoo as the segue, we're going to say welcome to the podcast. I'm Garrett Smith, regular host of the Goat Rodeo podcast. I'm joined by regular co-host Simon Kuhn, who joins me in beautiful Bozeman, Montana for one of the best parts of the year. Just smack dab middle of summer, Bozeman, Montana. It's an incredible place. And we both work at Reveal Technology, and we're killing it. I'll be honest. We're killing it, and we're excited. Also, we're gearing up for, maybe we'll use this also as a segue into the next topic, but we are gearing up for a America 250 hosted party at the company headquarters tonight. So the last night at the time of publication for the podcast, it will have already happened. So the mayhem.
Warriors and Quiet Water.
That's right. We're raising money for Warriors and Quiet Waters, a nonprofit serving global war and terror veterans through transition. And it's an incredible platform. And we're excited to celebrate America's 250th birthday and raise money for a noble cause. Encourage everybody out there to look at the Warriors and Quiet Waters .org website and look at their mission. It's an incredible platform. It's run by my old Marine boss and living legend, Brian Gilman, who retired as the chief of staff at Marine Corps Forces Special Operations Command, MARSOC, has been depicted in numerous, call it global war and terror, nonfiction memoirs for all kinds of different reasons. He's an incredible guy, deployed downrange with him, and now he's continuing to serve our community from the nonprofit space, and it's an awesome thing. Okay, with that, let's start off talking about venture deal book stuff. There haven't been any truly big new announcements in the investment space, but I did want to talk about a few different trends that we've been analyzing and tracking for a little bit within the defense technology ecosystem. So I'm going to talk about four of them. We've talked about all of these in the past, but in a consolidated fashion, I just want to talk about these trends. So first, there's been a trend line, and Simon, feel free to comment on this, but there's been a trend line in the venture space related to defense. From investing in software platforms, AI targeting software, AI applications, kind of military versions of SaaS or software as a service tools. And the trend line has been away from that and toward robotics, automation, hardware-centric software deployments, additive manufacturing, and a number of other items that really are more about heavy industrial capacity. So we're talking like Saronic's autonomous shipyards and Firestorm Labs additive manufacturing for drone platforms and new vehicles, new hardware capabilities like directed energy and electronic warfare capabilities. And so talk to us a little bit, Simon, about what you're observing from the software to heavy industrial capacity trend. That's trend number one.
So I think it's a little bit of a misread on like the macro, which is, you know, the historical macro is that America was an industrial manufacturing superpower, and this is where all money went for a very long time. And then we became a software superpower. And that's no surprise to anybody. You look at Alphabet, you look at Meta, at all these different corporations. And now, as you look at defense tech and the micro, it feels like it's all shifting back to hardware. I don't think that's what's happening. I think the two are blending. And I think if you look at any of these industrial players in the defense space in particular, there is such a massive software component to what modern manufacturing looks like that all of them are a blend of some sort. Even as Anduril has success with making hardware, obviously the Lattice platform is a like key pillar of their business. You look at folks like Mach Industries and Divergent, who are trying to bring new manufacturing processes, but simultaneously they have massive software backbones that enable their ability to bring these like flexible, innovative manufacturing processes to the table. So I think like it looks on the surface like, oh, they're dumping money back into hardware. But I think really what it is it's real blending. And all these companies have massive internal investments into their software stack that historical like heavy manufacturing did not have. And this is not necessarily new, but I do think it does look like a correction, so to speak. But I don't think any of the new defense tech players are like, yeah, I'm a pure hardware company. I didn't build my own software to support it. Like that doesn't exist.
I do think that it's interesting that the venture industry, which is often loath to invest in capital intensive projects, right, is now pivoting, at least in the defense tech sector, into hardware centric stuff. So I think there's some amount of tracking with the reindustrialized movement, or you know, reinvest in the defense industrial base movement, and it's probably also like the venture capital industry and the innovation kind of upstart non-traditional technology company becoming a little bit more like their customer. In other words, the customer still prefers very strongly to buy services contracts or hardware devices or hardware solutions that a prime contractor packages up, and there is software involved, but it's like baked deep into the solution package or baked deep into the contract and is otherwise seen as a hardware acquisition or a services package. And so I think that this is more about the industry, venture, and the non-traditional contractor base becoming a lot more like the customer. I think that trend is likely to continue. I still think that the massive value proposition of software in the space is undeniable, but I believe it's more about a delivery mechanism for high value software rather than hardware and heavy industrial capacity itself. Now, that being said, there is absolutely a space for innovators and for risk capital to get involved in reindustrializing. Think autonomous shipyards, because our Navy and our shipbuilding capacity is a fraction of what it used to be, and it's probably a fraction of what it should be, and ditto munitions manufacturing and other. So I think that's an interesting trend to consider. It also makes me think that early stage non-traditional types who believe themselves to be a software capability probably ought to find ways to partner or build into a services or a hardware footing to transact with this specific customer. But I think, again, time will tell. Second trend line, I'm going to call this one high flyer consolidation, or a winner takes all trend. So 90% of defense technology venture capital activity is going into the top 10 largest growth stage venture plays. So we're thinking Anduril, Shield AI, et cetera, et cetera. 90% of all invested defense venture capital, meaning that early stage deals, even though there are plenty still going on, really are accounting for a tiny fraction of the overall investment activity. And what this probably means is that investors and firms are holding on to a lot more, call it dry powder, so that they can dump more capital into the clear winners or category leaders, and are waiting for those trend lines to emerge with companies within a category and then dumping lots of capital in later, which is backed up by kind of this this notion of mega rounds going on. So these gigantic all the way from like gigantic observed Series Seed and Series A investments, all the way through to like multi-billion dollar Series Ds, you know, and beyond. So what do you think about this winner takes all dynamic in the venture-backed ecosystem, Simon?
It's hard for me to wrap my mind around, because the philosophy of participating in this industry requires like a level of confidence that cannot possibly survive reality for the vast majority of participants. And so I'm always shocked by the like, hey, the vast majority of us are going to get sucked up. That is like the nature of this thing. And, you know, I think Anduril is the best example right now, where you look at the like the last five major Anduril product awards and like contracts and wins are almost entirely companies that they bought. And they are, you know, kind of, you know, Anduril built this in 2 years. Like, yeah, the company you bought started building it 5 years ago. And then in the last 2 years, you turned it into an Anduril product. But you're neither wrong, nor is this like pure Anduril DNA and all these things. You're doing a very smart, like, roll-up strategy. And yet everyone thinks they're going to be the big winner. So as a person who spent most of his career in government service and is still kind of wrapping his head around how people talk about being in the private sector and like think about their longevity in the private sector, it's interesting to me to watch these folks who at some point are going to start pulling the ladder up behind them, because the game is not to build the biggest possible company and then help 100 other people also build big companies. It's to build the biggest possible company and then absorb or push out the next 100 competitors, right? Like that's the intent. There was a really interesting Owen West post this past week.
Owen West, DIU director.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're probably under a rock if you're watching this and you don't know who Owen West is, but we should probably tell him. So Owen West, the current director of DIU, and he made an interesting post about if you looked at the 26 largest, you know, companies in the stock market 30 years ago, only one of them is still in the top 25. Whereas if you look at the largest 25 defense company 25 years ago, the list is almost identical with the exception of one or two. And I think this like ties these two trends together, which is we're essentially trying to speed run re-injecting capitalism into a very stagnant, like government protected market. And that includes like going through the entire software revolution and then the software defined hardware revolution, and also like recapitalization of all these like old giants. Like, when we talk about capital intensive projects, right? Most folks are not going to go build factories. They're going to buy old factories and refurbish them because it's so much cheaper. And we are, again, we're like speed running the macro economy of America within our own ecosystem. It's pretty fascinating.
I totally agree. I think that this increases the pressure or stress, certainly pressure or the motivation for younger projects to very rapidly scale. And I think the risk that we run collectively as a venture-backed ecosystem is that there will be a lot of kind of vapor and hype in the early stages that attempt to get a bunch of venture capital momentum behind them. And it's almost like capacity and scale ahead of product and traction, simply to define oneself as a category leader so that they draw the preponderance of that category's venture and risk capital activity. And I'm not saying that's a wrong tactic. I'm saying that we collectively need to be on guard for lots of vaporous projects out there that are simply building on a basis of momentum and scale and category leadership without actually having transited the valley of death. As an example, and I'll use this to segue into the third trend line, which is what I'm going to call the post-valley contracting kind of flywheel. Companies need to, at some point, manifest true traction. And the way that that happens is by winning true contracts, production-grade contracts, prime contracts, OTs, and the likes of, you know, phase three SBIRs or IDIQs that are not only have like interesting ceilings, but are having actual transactions on the contract vehicles. And so at this point, this third trend line is all about venture capitalists waking up finally to the idea that a phase one SBIR ain't active customer traction, right? Like basically anybody can go out and win a phase one SBIR contract. And likely, if they just check all the right boxes along the RDT&E pathway, can get to it. But it takes a lot of energy and muscle and know-how and guts and everything else to transit beyond those forms of early stage R&D contracting into real production-grade contracts. Venture capitalists, this is the trend line, venture capitalists are observing this trend and basically are not investing like they used to 2 to 3 to 4 years ago in those phase one SBIR companies. What they're looking for is production grade contracts or line of sight to production grade contracts or the like. So Simon, talk to us about your observations on that trend line.
So there's a real dilemma that's developing here. And I'm thinking specifically about recent news around Stark, right? So Stark just did a huge raise, 10 days ago, something like that. And they won a very large contract with the German military, $2.5 billion back in February, €2.5 billion back in February. And however, their most recent like interceptor test, they failed. They did not hit a single thing. And that was back in October. And so there is like, the investors saw a production grade contract and are ready to dump money in. The technology has not yet proven itself. And is in fact failed on a pretty dramatic stage at least once, which could, you know, we've seen this many times before. Failure could lead to incredible like redevelopment and solving problems, or it could just be failure. They, like, it can go both ways. It's not a guarantee of either outcome. Unlike the rest of the world, this is not, you know, Uber and DoorDash. This is people's lives, like people's lives in combat on the front lines. And so, you know, there's a video going around, and this kind of ties into one of the things I wanted to talk about. There's a video going around right now of Ukrainians running down a Shahed drone with an American-funded piece of technology built by, it's called the MareOps. It's built by Project Eagle, you know, Eric Schmidt-backed sort of American-Ukrainian drone interceptor partnership. But that doesn't really mean anything from like a business perspective. The ability to build something and put it in the hand of Ukrainians and have them go use it does not translate to venture necessarily, because it's not a production contract. So even though that tech now has this like incredible video of it working really well, they don't as of yet have like the same type of round that Stark just had, even though there's videos of that not working very well. But the difference is a production contract, which comes with a whole lot of working the customer and the politics, as you know, as it relates, like an American company probably could not have won a €2.5 billion German contract to like build the backbone for That's political right. reasons and for like, you know, parochial industrial base reasons in Germany that are perfectly valid. Now, of course, MareOps being Eric Schmidt backed probably won't have a hard time finding capital and folks that are willing to like participate in rounds with that kind of name brand recognition behind it. But like it points to a very real problem of there's a lot of good tech out there that maybe isn't playing that game as well. And we want to believe that defense tech is built entirely on the merits of the tech and its ability to save lives and like prosecute effects against the enemy. That's not necessarily true. That will not always line up with the way raising and winning contracts work. These are their own bureaucracies with politics and everything else that comes with that.
Yep, I couldn't agree. Couldn't agree more. I think that actually is a very useful segue into the fourth trend line that I'll talk about, and then I'll hand the mic definitively over to you. We can dig into that that use case that you just described for counter Shahed operations in Ukraine. But the a very useful fourth trend line, which parallels that topic exactly, is this defense technology venture surge in Europe. So a number of funds are dumping a massive amount of venture capital into European projects. So North America remains obviously the capital heavyweight in the category, capturing something between 85 to 95% of total capital allocations. But European venture capital deployments in defense technology, it's multiplied several times over in the past couple of years. So Germany's got a fund called FCF, and there are a bunch of other multi-stage European defense technology venture groups. They're rapidly standing up localized defense funds, looking to scale sovereign AI. So this is the built in Europe, built for Europe, sovereign kind of AI capability. Alternative GPS denied and assured position navigation timing systems, tactical drone and tactical drone defense and counter UAS platforms and hardware, all within the European umbrella. Slack-jawed sycophant when it comes to Trump and Trump policy, but it is very interesting that the Trump era, and call it whatever tactics he used to put a bunch of pressure onto Europe to like think about up-leveling its own defense and reinvesting has in some level been effective. Is that a good thing over time? It's hard for me to get excited. Having read a number of history books, it's hard for me to get excited about Germany reinvesting in its military muscle yet again in the continent, right? So that being said, Ukraine on the rise, Russia, revisionist Russia on the move. I think there's a necessity here, and it's good to see European defense tech surge. It also means that if American projects want to get backed by European firms and deploy capability into Europe, there's a rising coterie of funds interested in making those kinds of investments and transferring or expanding that technology footprint into mainland Europe. So macro outlook here is that the second half of 2026 is probably going to be just as frothy and just as exciting in the defense technology venture scene as it has been over the first half of 2026, which is already greater in defense technology venture capital investment volume than the entirety of 2025. So we're on a track here. Simon, what do you want to use that as a segue into maybe deeper conversation on the Ukraine situation?
I mean, before we jump off of it, I do want to like comment on the geopolitics of that, because there is some sticky contradictions that happen in this idea of like, okay, we want our allies to spend more money on defense and take responsibility for more of their own defense needs. However, one of the major exports of America is defense. So if the like response is to build their own defense production capacity at the same time, that's money that's no longer flowing to us. And now it's also capital, that American capital being invested in European projects. I'm not saying this is like a good or bad. It could end up being a net negative or a net positive. It's probably a net positive for like capabilities and what actually comes out of this, right? More entrants, more ideas. One presumes like the cream will rise to the top. However, would I rather see a like $3 billion round for an American company versus a German company? Yeah, I would. I'm not at all afraid to say that. Like and especially if it's American capital flowing out to build factories in Germany now. Cool. What did we get there? So I have some concerns about that. That being said, I am like very happy to see, the Ukrainians winning, which is not something I think any of us anticipated a year ago, to be on such a strong footing that they're on now. And you can't
include, deep strikes, deep drone strike, drone swarm strikes,
hundreds of strikes a day
in Moscow,
in Russian territory, on Moscow. Yeah. So like there is a truly like, this is a Machiavellian sort of topic, in that I do want to see, the West and allies of the West to be productive members and be able to defend themselves and have countries like Ukraine being able to fight back against like aggressive neighbors like Russia. But it sounds like at some point, this is all good right now while the wave is rising. At some point, there's going to be an ebb and flow to the capital. And if we are splitting that pie between a ton of new European entrants in addition to new American entrants, like there's going to be lean times at some point, and we may regret some of it, at least from like an American industrial capacity standpoint. So something to think about. To your earlier point though, right, like, we're not really going to know. Like, it's not worth getting up in arms about like, oh, this X, Y, or Z is a disaster for the alliance. Like, it may or may not be. Give it some time. For most of it, I don't love European drawdown, but it'll be interesting to see where this all shakes out in the end. But there is a good segue there, which is even as these companies are growing and you see American capital flowing into European companies, the utility of like the American expertise and the American innovation ecosystem is in no way diminished. And I feel like there's this almost counter-logical thread of like, well, the U.S. is not at war and Ukraine's at war, so the Ukraine is developing all the things about how war needs to actually be fought, and the U.S. is wildly unprepared. And then, I wake up today and I see this video of like, oh, Ukrainians have released a video running down a Shahid drone, a drone that took out an American Apache helicopter this last month. And what did they run it down with? An American interceptor system. So we are still, and once again, MAROPS, built by Project Eagle, which is a partnership between the U.S. and Ukraine. But America, don't forget, we're the best at this game. And a lot of that is like blood, sweat, and tears from decades at thinking and ideating and like putting boots on the ground and figuring out what it means to wage war.
Yeah, let me jump in with maybe a sidebar that will touch not only on this, but on our previous topic about venture capital activity in the defense and dual use space. So let's talk SpaceX IPO, right? So the SpaceX IPO, which I think debuted at $1.7+ trillion and then briefly cleared $2.1 trillion in market cap over the subsequent week or two of trading. What that meant was very specifically, it meant that investors putting money into aggressively aspirational, dual-use, capital-intensive technology companies, SpaceX, can achieve liquidity on the back end. In other words, all these venture capitalists who piled money into SpaceX 10, 15 years ago, and then all the more recent ones who put money into it because it had this dual-use flavoring as a category winner, as a category, a global category dominator in the defense technology space, are now getting liquidity, right? And so what that means is that not only is that seen as the premier capability within its category, probably just dominant in that space generally across the globe, it is actually now going to inspire yet another generation of investment into either hardcore defense technology or dual use projects that allow for a level of capital intensivity that we wouldn't have seen in a previous generation. And so, I mean, this is why an aggressive entrepreneur who puts it all on the line to build a company like that, that is initially seen as, you know, a pipe dream or counterintuitive or whatever, yields so much upside on that. This is why Elon Musk is the world's first trillionaire in quotes. And a couple of other trends that will likely push to the fore is that there will be an upward pressure on scale stage valuations within the defense technology space, specifically for those companies that are doing category defining work in places like war zone Ukraine. So I would expect that Project Eagle and really any Schmidt umbrella company looking into the dual use and defense technology space will draw and demand a much higher valuation, right? As we're seeing that category winners absolutely dominate. And once they actually achieve a liquid state, call it an IPO, direct listing, you know, M&A, whatever, the market is supporting massive valuation. So SpaceX debuted at over 100x trailing revenue, which was inflated by its, you know, narrative around space-based AI computing and a bunch of other things. That's the visionary aspirational stuff.
Yeah.
But it describes how liquidity can occur in capital-intensive, aspirational, category-defining, and counterintuitive projects, or at least counterintuitive at the outset. And I think this is also going to draw massive institutional and sovereign wealth capital into the space, which is a requirement if you're going to get into these capital-intensive projects, because venture capital can only take you so far.
Yeah, I mean, the impact of SpaceX, I don't think, can be overstated. And there's some other large companies that have obviously emerged, but SpaceX is the only one that I think truly outperforms the hype. And there is there's real challenges associated with this, and SpaceX is going to run into it. We are going to run into it with SpaceX first. And I'm referencing things like, you know, access to Starlink and the Ukraine conflict, the very like real life challenge of doing AI in space, doing any kind of compute in space, and like heat transfer, and like the physical limitations of stuff. So like the first version of aspiration for SpaceX was just, can it be built in America? And like solving that alone was an extraordinary challenge, but it is ultimately like a cultural, capital, bureaucratic challenge. They are now looking at aspirational, like how far can I stretch the physics of doing things in space, which is, as far as I understand, it much harder. The laws of physics are much more immutable than, you know, recreating industrial capacity. But all of this relies on a federal government that has money and contracts to award. And it wasn't even 10 years ago that SpaceX was in a position where the federal government was spending $1 billion to build a competitor rocket to the Falcon, which is like, it's such a fascinating thing to think about. This is like a no bullshit competition at the NRO sending satellites into space, and they had one available rocket, and it was built with Russian technology. And so they knew, and this was UGA, why can't I remember the name of like the weird conglomerate between the primes to launch rockets. It's escaping my, that's how bad things have gotten.
ULA.
ULA, right? So ULA had a Russian designed rocket, which is its own funny piece of politics, because the best way to keep Russians from building missiles is to hire all the Russians and have them build rockets for us. But at the same time, we don't love that we're using Russian technology. And so the government had this contract bid out, and SpaceX was going to compete with an American-built piece of technology, and American engineers, and an American supply chain, and it already works. And America said, that's not enough. The government said, that's not enough entrants. So we're going to give $1 billion to ULA to build a competitor. That's insane. That's an insane thing to think of. And that was the position SpaceX was in 9 years ago, right? Trying to convince America to not spend $1 billion to build competition to an American company, and rather like double down on this. So, you know, fast forward to right now, as we get into my favorite perennial topic, if those funding streams do not exist, there can be no future SpaceX, right? SpaceX was competing for $1 billion contracts 10 years ago. If that opportunity does not materialize, SpaceX does not get to scale and grow and do what it does now, which is, you know, provide world-class communication satellites to everybody, commercial and military and federal. They do all of it. And unfortunately, things have gotten kind of worse, even as the federal government has gotten more interested in these like defense tech innovation spaces and building more contract vehicles and more pots of money for folks to compete on. Congress has gotten worse about keeping the trains running on time. To actually fund these projects and like allow all these wonderful contracting officers to spend dollars.
Wait, Simon, they're not getting legislative work done on time?
In fact, they're getting nothing done.
They're getting nothing done, huh?
Nothing at all. So last time we talked about this, you know,
the U.S. Congress.
Yeah, yes, that's the one. The same U.S. Congress, which is
breaking news.
As of right now, entirely beholden to the state of Florida, from what I understand from recent reporting. But it's things. Political events outside of the defense space are haranguing Congress, and that is preventing the passage of the National Defense Authorization Act, and it is preventing us from even turning to talking about appropriations. And, you know, we talked last time about a war supplemental and how much the war costs, but the politicians, no one's stories are lining up. So Russ Vought from OMB came to the Hill last week, and he testified on how much the war in Iran costs. And he said it was about $30 billion. And the White House that week also made their request for a supplemental. They requested $67 billion for defense, and then another $22 billion for like disaster relief and food aid for some events that have happened. Those numbers don't line up immediately. Hey, the war costs $30 billion. I need $67 billion. That's not a great opening position for any negotiation, but it's made worse by the fact that the House has essentially gone into revolt over a set of different like immigration and voters' rights pieces of legislation, and all of our legislators have ended session early and left town. So neither House of Congress comes back into session until July 13th. When they come back, the Senate will have 5 more weeks of voting days. Excuse me, the Senate will have 7 weeks of voting days. The House will only have 5. So there will be 5 weeks left before midterms where both the Senate and the House are in session and could potentially do any number of things, to include all 12 of the appropriations bills to fund the entire government, the NDAA on both sides, a potential supplemental to fund the war. And let's be clear, the money is running out at DOD because they spent a lot of it on the war. So they are now seizing up travel and like reducing training budgets because they spent their money on the war. And then a potential third reconciliation bill, which is $350 billion of the $1.5 trillion that everyone's been talking about. That math ain't mathing. There's just no way. And the big appropriations bills will be the first ones to go. They'll do a CR and they'll push them off. And I think NDAA probably goes to the wayside as well. We didn't finish the NDAA last year until December, and I think we're probably headed for a similar thing. The question becomes, are we going to paralyze the entire like defense ecosystem while House members and Senate members debate whether or not to strengthen voter ID laws?
Right. Right. So you're saying that your prognosis here is that I'm putting words in your mouth, but I want you to confirm, deny, and correct if useful. So putting words in your mouth, you're saying that we expect full year CRs at the end of this, or we just expect CRs to cover the gap before they pass NDAA, the defense appropriations bills, that will still happen, but it will be delayed as we've seen the trend line for now many years, but at least to December.
I think we get short-term CRs. We do this all the time. I think it's very stupid, but I think we get short-term CRs to get us past the midterms. But I think in real life, we probably don't appropriate till December. And so we end up doing like a couple of short CRs in a row, which is the height of stupidity. Just push it out to December. You know you're not going to get done until December. But not full year. I don't anticipate full year CRs. I think that would be unusual. Once you get past November, I think the temperature comes way down, and like the possibility, like if the Democrats manage to flip either the House or the Senate, the possibility of ever doing the Save America voter right bill turns to zero. Like it goes away. No Dem-controlled House is going to let that bill move forward. So we'll just stop talking about it. Like we'll sideline it.
So we're saying that the Overton window, so to speak, opens up again in December for a lower temperature resumption of congressional activity around authorizations and appropriations, and that we expect a delayed set of bills, but we expect the bills.
It could happen a little bit earlier because it depends on what happens in the elections, right? I mean, if the Republicans sweep and retain control, then November, things turn right back on, right? We go right into reconciliation. We go right into these bills, and like, you're just going to have to eat it.
That doesn't seem likely. And I don't think you would say that's likely.
The math is too hard to do right now. And I am very, I've been wrong, I think, about every election I've ever tried to make a prediction on. Electoral politics is much, much harder than even congressional like procedural politics, which much more comfortable with.
Yeah.
But I think with all the gerrymandering stuff that's happened, the Supreme Court just upended campaign finance rules yesterday. It's very hard to like math out what's going on. Michael Bennett, for example, senator from Colorado, just lost his primary to run for the governorship of Colorado. He is the first sitting senator to lose a primary for governor in like 40 years. And that's Dem side, right? Like that is Dem on Dem violence. So I don't know what's going to happen. It's very hard to predict. You look at the elections in New York and all of the, sort of traditional Democrats that lost primaries to DSA endorsed candidates, which there was like four or five, but the one they wanted most did not. Richie Torres still did very well. And he was probably like the number one target of to DSA aligned candidates. It's
a guy
tough.
Like Richie Torres just makes too much sense though. So we're getting into like, you know, local congressional district esoteric.
All politics is local. All of it.
Of course. I'm just thinking that I bet you we don't have a single Goat Rodeo listener or viewer living in Richie Torres' district in New York. I'm just guessing.
There's a lot of money in New York. Maybe, I don't know.
I'm just saying, I bet nobody's following that. Like you are probably following that, but I appreciate Richie Torres because he's sort of a reasoned, level-headed, or at least the appearance of such member of a member of Congress who is charting a centrist path, which puts him directly in the crosshairs of the frothy red-eyed, primary activist blocks of both ends of the political spectrum.
So
I think it's an encouraging sign that a guy like him, continues to throw that centrist moderate weight around.
But the thing to watch with Torres and with campaigns like this is Torres's campaign went very quiet, which is a thing you do when you feel really comfortable with your base and you just anticipate that there's not a whole lot of juice for the squeeze getting into these fights. And that was essentially what Torres did late in the game. And he did very well in his primary. But he is an exception to the rule as far as how Democrat primaries have gone. It's very similar to like the MAGA movement and the Tea Party movements that swept the Republican Party in years past. These primaries were not good for you know, mainstream Democrats, I should say.
Yeah.
And that's going to make the math complicated all over. I think anyone who's saying really hard and fast, here's what's going to happen in the midterms, it's probably full of shit. And I am deeply mistrustful. They've got something to gain. And I understand being like, I work for this campaign. We're definitely going to win. Like, yeah, you have to, just like venture capital, you need to believe what you're saying. It's no good if you don't like go all in on your own personal brand, what you're trying to get done there. But I'm not making any big bets. I'm waiting to see who's left standing at the end.
In that race, just look this up. Torres raised $6.6 million in campaign receipts during this cycle with what this analysis is calling an insulated war chest of over $14.5 million in cash on hand for the race. By comparison, his opponent, Michael Blake, only raised $360,000 or so in total fundraising receipts.
So then it wasn't nearly as competitive as I thought it was, yeah.
I don't think, well, at least not in the fundraising front. Maybe the vote was closer, right?
Fundraising is a large portion of the game.
But I mean, Torres won with 71.9% of the vote.
Yeah,
this was an obvious blowout. And what it says to me is that the key campaign issues probably resulted in people accepting that the more moderate, or at least not, hard left ideological position he took on things like Israel and other stuff. He must be satisfying the base, right? I mean, he must be enough of the base and a lot of the centrists.
He clearly has like the pulse of his district. What's fascinating is that like those districts are all so close to each other. So yeah, not even 2 miles down the road, it is like a complete opposite story with Dan Golden and Brad Lander. Like a total reversal of all of those numbers. So it's, like I said, the math is crazy. Up is down, left is right. And it's going to get weirder as the parties settle into the new realities of this like Supreme Court finance decision, which is a whole nother mess that we don't have to go into at depth. It'll take too long.
Let's tee that up for a future Goat Rodeo discussion. Sure. Let's wrap things today, though, by talking about what Simon Kuhn's plans are for celebrating America's 250th birthday. I know tonight, or last night, at the time of publication of the podcast, we'll have executed the Reveal America 250 Worries in Quiet Waters fundraiser party. But outside of that, what are you planning? You getting a new tattoo? Is it somewhere else?
I'm going to go home and watch Independence Day starring Will Smith, as I do every July 4th.
Starring Will Smith and Montana ranch owner Bill Pullman,
who lives out in Whitehall.
Again,
I'm
not going to dox President Bill Pullman, but he does live out in Whitehall on a beautiful piece of property.
That's it. Those are my plans. I don't care for fun. Fun's not my thing. So I'll enjoy a nice movie night.
But you are happy about America turning 250 years old, right? Come on.
Sure.
Sure.
Okay. I don't know that I've ever really thought about the birthday thing. Maybe I'll go buy a new American flag, but up front.
But you don't want to get too worked up over it.
I like to think, compared to the average person, I am fairly worked up about America at all times. And then when the America holiday comes around, I'm like, I was already here.
Yeah.
I already had the American flag on the front of the house. Like, nice. You guys are going to join in for a day? All right.
Everyone else is catching up to you.
As a lifelong contrarian, I have to find some gray cloud to add to the mix.
Of course, yeah. As the resident Eeyore.
But there's no gray clouds when it comes to Independence Day starring Will Smith. Flawless film.
Correct. Flawless, you know why I love that movie? It's about aliens. Dude, it's
got everything. It's got Marines, it's got aliens, it's got Jeff Goldblum being weird and funny the whole time, like the entire time.
It's got
time.
Vivica Fox before she did Kill Bill.
Yeah. It's a killer. Whole movie's a killer.
It's a great
Everyone
movie.
Should go watch it. And the visual effects are still really good because it's like, you know, that old school hybrid physical and models and all that cool stuff.
I wonder what kind of the Zoomer crowd think. You know, there's this whole like very online Jeff Goldblum kind of meme thing, right? And he's obviously like a fixture in the meme space somehow. I don't really understand how that happened, but he's in his probably 60s, maybe even early 70s at this point. I wonder what Zoomers think when they watch old movies, you know, like Independence Day and Jeff Goldblum, or Jurassic Park, and Jeff Goldblum's at his prime, you know, like at his,
in a tank
at his
top,
sweaty chest prime.
Yeah, just crushing it.
Yeah.
I got to assume they love it. Well, it's not
they have to. It's hard not to love. It's hard not to love. And then you go down like the Wes Anderson rabbit hole and start watching The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and you get a whole different take on what Goldblum is all about. And maybe that's all indicative of the trend here. Okay. Well, I plan on being outside on the 4th, and this is the season to be outside in Montana.
It's 100 degrees on the East Coast. I will not be outside.
Yeah, it's brutal. You should just stay here. You should just stay here. Okay. Thanks to Morrissey and Suedehead. Thanks to Simon Kuhn. And thanks to everybody joining us. This is Garrett Smith, and we're signing off. We'll see you next time.